This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are about 12,000 students enrolled at any given time in the Vermont State College System. That's Castleton, Johnson, and Linden State, plus Vermont Technical College and the Community College of Vermont, which has about a dozen locations around the state. But Vermont is not doing a very good job of getting students from high school graduation all the way through to a college degree. Funding is a big problem. The state colleges cost a lot more for Vermonters than public institutions do in many other states. But there are other reasons, too. Some students aren't coming out of high school prepared for college. And when they have to take remedial classes for no college credit, it makes it less likely that they're going to have the time, money, or motivation to get to graduation. Today on the program, we're going to talk about how Vermont could improve and why the state chronically underfunds its higher education system. We're joined now by Jeb Spalding, Chancellor of the Vermont State Colleges, and Yasmin Ziesler, VSC's Chief Academic and Technology Officer. It's a pleasure to have you both on the show.
Thank you very much, Jane.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the barriers just to getting to college and getting through college generally for Vermont students, and then we can get into some of the funding issues specifically with the Vermont State Colleges. Fewer than half of all Vermont high school graduates will go on to earn a post-secondary degree. And there are two issues, getting kids to go to college in the first place and then, as I said, getting them to graduation. So they're intertwined issues, but also somewhat separate. Let's start with what the barriers are just to preventing students from thinking about college as an option. Yasmin Ziesler, this is something you work on.
Sure. So one of the things we know from our data, and VSEC has been a great partner in helping us understand this, as well as the Agency of Education, is that if you are not from a college-going family where there's experience in your family of going to college, or if you're from a family with very modest economic circumstances, those students we know are going to college at a much lower rate in Vermont, those Vermont high school graduates. So, for example, 35% of students from low-income families in Vermont go on to college. It's over 60% for students who come from more affluent backgrounds. So all of the factors of knowing how to get to college, of understanding why it's important, and maybe even understanding the how do I figure out what a major is and dealing with some of the normal anxieties that students have about going to college, all of those things are important to tackle.
Money, too?
And absolutely. Money is a part of that as well. Yeah.
But the one thing I'd love to just emphasize about the cost of college or university is that very few students pay the announced tuition rate. So if there are parents out listening or prospective students, they ought to look more deeply. And every college is required to have a net price calculator on their website. And it takes a little bit of work to go in and say, how many siblings do you have and what your income is and all these kind of things like that. But what people need to know is that whether they're one of our state colleges or whether it's the university or one of the private colleges in Vermont or elsewhere, most people are getting a discount off of the tuition. It actually is one of the major challenges we face as a college. But I did want to take the opportunity to say to prospective students, look more deeply. It might be more affordable than you think.
Although, I mean, certainly that's true and there are grants, but most college students are not paying the full ticket price, but they're also coming out with lots of debt.
They are. But when you hear those things of they come out with $100,000 worth of debt or something like that, that would not be typical. In fact, it would be practically unheard of with a four-year bachelor's degree for the Vermont State Colleges. I think the average amount of debt that people have averages like $27,000 to maybe $30,000 at the most.
And that's because it looks like for most of the state colleges, not necessarily for the Community College of Vermont, but for most of the state colleges, it would be about $100,000 for a four-year degree if you're paying room and board and tuition and the full comprehensive fee.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why state colleges are situated throughout the state and the community college has a dozen locations because many of our students, particularly ones that come from limited means, are commuting and they're trying to save money and not pay room and board. They do miss a certain part of the experience, but when we talk about the $20,000 to $25,000 a year, that's the tuition plus all the room and board and fees.
We're talking today about why Vermont State College System is strapped for cash. We're looking specifically right now at what the barriers are to getting students into the system and then keeping them there. There are about 12,000 students who enroll in the state college system. If you're one of them or a graduate, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Yasmin Ziesler, what about for students who do enroll in a college but don't graduate? I mean, if you look at the graduation rates for the Vermont State Colleges, other than the Vermont Technical College, none of them are over 50%.
Right. And I think the first thing to remember about that is that when we compare ourselves nationally, this isn't a Vermont State College problem. This is really nationally for public higher education. It's been the norm that under 50% of students are graduating from college. And we're really at a time in our society where that's no longer acceptable. It might have been okay in the past for students to leave.
Not acceptable. Why? Because of the money they've spent or because they need a degree to go further?
They need a degree. Right. Right.
The second one?
Yeah, the second one.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's more critical than ever for both the individual and for the collective, the state and citizens. I mean, we know we've seen the recent reports that say that 60% of the jobs in Vermont by 2020 will require some kind of post-secondary credential, and we're not on track to get to there. So, you know, one, that's a problem for individuals, but it's also a problem for the state's economy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the reasons for the lack of graduation, you know, there was a 2009 study by Public Agenda that asked, specifically went out and surveyed students who didn't finish college. And they discovered that over half of students, the number one reason they said was, gee, I need to work. And it was just too difficult to prioritize continuing with college at that point. That said, there are certainly many things that we can do within our colleges. And that's, again, nationally, everybody is thinking about and trying to learn from each other ways to do that. So we actually just had a team come back from the Complete College America Institute, where we were learning about different models of working on students who need some additional support to be successful in college courses.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that you've found and that others have found around the country is this need for remedial education for students who are enrolling in colleges. And this does happen in the Vermont State College system as well. Students who've graduated from high school but then need to take remedial courses before they can enroll in college courses. And those remedial courses usually are not for college credit. That's so right. These are students who have to pay to take a course just to get to the courses that they have to pay for to go to college. One of the purposes of a high school degree is to prepare you for post-secondary education. So is it that we're failing in high school, or there's a disconnect between our college classes and our high school classes? I mean, why are so many students needing remedial education? Jeb Spalding?
Well, Jane, I know I'm sure you can answer that question largely yourself and would know that it's not just one thing, and a lot of fingers need to be involved in the pie. Certainly, you know, there are many families that are struggling economically. We've got substance abuse issues. There are a lot of, you know, family situations that don't make it easy for somebody to succeed in high school.
But these are kids who graduated. So the school has said you are prepared for post-secondary education.
Well, graduated.
That is part of the purpose of a high school degree.
Well, we're in Vermont. We are, and somebody involved in higher education, I'm very supportive of our Common Core and moving to our smarter balanced assessments. And that's part of making sure that we do have standards and that we're moving people towards those standards. But again, you know, I mean, unless you're planning to just leave people in high school forever, they generally get out at some point. And I think we all have a role in trying to make sure that they are prepared for college level work when they get out. And one of the, you know, the interesting things about Vermont is that while we have a very high high school graduation rate, our continuation rate onto college is not something to be admired compared to other New England states or nationally.
So what do you think then should be done to bridge that gap between what students are coming out of high school with and what they need to go on successfully directly into college?
Well, again, so to have them prepared to go on to college when they get out of high school, a lot of people are involved. I think, yes, higher education has a role, too, to make sure that we're clear on what they need when they get here. The high schools need to make sure that the teachers are competent and that the students know what courses they need to take in order to be successful in college. And then families and the society has a role. So we all have a role to help students be prepared. Once they get to college, that's a whole nother cup of tea. And as you pointed out and Yasmin has, our college completion rates once they get to us are about the national average for our peer group. But that's not good enough. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, there's half of them aren't graduating in the end. And what we're trying to do is look for the promising ways that we can actually provide more support for our students. In the Complete College America that Yasmin mentioned and you asked about, you know, one of the things they found is that, you know, if students are enrolled in remedial courses alone, that their chances of graduating eventually are significantly less than they would otherwise be. So, you know, I want to really emphasize one point that came up in a couple of news stories last week about Complete College America remedial courses and college-level courses. What they're not saying is that you ought to get college credit for remedial courses. And I just want to make sure the readers or the listeners understand that. What their thought is that seems to be borne out by research is that getting students enrolled in college courses, credit-bearing courses, and providing remedial support at the same time is a much more effective way of actually moving students through to graduation.
Yasmin Ziesler, jump in here.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things to remember is that academic skills and readiness for college, right, that's something that you really have to maintain. And so if we have students who take a year off between high school and college, right, they're probably not doing the kind of rigorous math that would let you go into a college-level course and being absolutely ready to go. So it's, you know, it's not a matter of starting students back at zero and repeating a lot of work. It's just saying, look, you need to stay really focused and brushed up. And to me, one of the most exciting strategies that we already have underway in Vermont is our dual enrollment program, because that, you know, can be a real motivator for a student to take a college-level course and kind of keep really active, particularly during grade 12, so that they're ready to go on and kind of sharpen.
And how would you imagine seeing this combination of remedial courses and college credit courses working for, let's say, a student enrolls in one of the state colleges and needs some of that remedial math that you're mm-hmm. talking about? Right. Can you paint a picture of what that would look
like? Sure. So CCV has actually been taking a lead in piloting a program of providing a math course with some additional support. It might be some online modules, you know, some additional, it could be lab time. They're doing it also on the English side of basically taking two courses at the same time, one that is a support course to support their college-level writing course. And that's a model that was one of the ones we heard about nationally, and CCV has been doing it for a while.
So in the end, the student comes out with the credits for that English course, but they've also been doing that remedial work within the course, basically.
Exactly.
And would that work, do you think, at the state colleges beyond CCV?
I think it certainly has potential. You know, some of our colleges are thinking about some new ideas for the first time. I'm going to hear back from them in a few days, so I'm really excited to see exactly what they think will work in each context. Each of our colleges is very different.
And change doesn't happen overnight, but recently we were talking with some counterparts of mine and their team in Tennessee, where they've piloted at all of the colleges within the – they have different – within the Tennessee system – not the University of Tennessee. They've piloted the co-remediation, and they are moving to it this fall in all of their colleges. And I think there were 38 of them in their system out there. So, we need to work through this stuff methodically and make sure people are prepared and we don't make mistakes as we do it. But I think there are some models out there that we wouldn't be the first ones to go down that road.
We're talking today about the Vermont State College system and looking right now at how to improve the completion rate for students who enroll in the state colleges. If you have a question or a thought you'd like to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Sabra is on the line with us from Verscher. Hi, Sabra. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the speakers how they thought it would impact the state colleges and our economy if the people who are running for president who are proposing free college tuition and ending student debt or to get elected, and that's all. Thanks very much.
Sabra, thanks for the call. Okay, so we've been talking about finances as one of the barriers to going to college and completing college. People who say, I have to work, I have to get a job. Sabra's asking, what about this platform of free college tuition? How would that change things? Jeb Spaulding?
Well, I think it's a natural evolution that this country is going to go through. Exactly how you provide that education, is there any cost? Is it sliding scale? There are some things that need to be worked out. But there was a time in this country where, you know, an eighth grade education was good enough for most people. And then you got to a point where a high school education was good enough for most people. And now we know that you need some level of post-secondary education. I say that, I emphasize post-secondary, because it's not that everybody needs to have a doctoral degree or a bachelor's degree or even an associate's degree, even though you can see the evidence is clear that, you know, the higher you go up in that educational ladder, your lifetime earnings are, you know, unless you're an exception, are going to be significantly higher because of that. But I think it will become a natural occurrence in this country that we're going to have some level, probably 2 years of college that should be publicly supported after high school. So I think those conversations on a national level are important. Whether it happens in the next year or two, I don't know, because, you know, they're having some budgetary issues down there and nobody wants to raise taxes for virtually anything in on a national or even a state level for that matter. So I don't know that it'll happen right away, but I think those conversations are very constructive, and I think it would be really helpful for the economic prospects of Vermonters and Americans. And it would actually help our national economy compared to our global competitors as well.
Yasmin Ziesler, is this something that you feel comfortable saying where you stand on?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've seen some projections that think about what if we don't get to that 60% of Vermonters who have some kind of credential that Jeb mentioned. And, you know, if we don't get there, it means people aren't earning as high incomes. They're not filling the needs of employers here in Vermont. And that could be as much as $15 million annually is what I've seen some of the economic projections around not getting to that goal. So there, it is a serious thing for us to think about as a state.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that when we come back from the break, because if this is something that both of you are saying is an imperative, that people need post-secondary education and it needs to be funded, why isn't the state of Vermont funding it? We're going to talk about that. Jeb Spaulding, you've had a lot of positions in state government, so you can look at this from a lot of different angles. And listeners, you can share your questions, your thoughts with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm joined by two of the leaders of the Vermont State Colleges, Chancellor Jeb Spaulding and Chief Academic and Technology Officer Yasmin Ziesler. We've been looking at the funding issues facing the state college system and students who are enrolling in the colleges. We're hearing from some of you. If you have an experience you'd like to share, post it on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Dave writes, Vermont is doing far worse than many other states in making college affordable. The Green Mountain State ranks 49 out of 50 states in the price of tuition at public four-year and two-year institutions. The Green Mountain State relies more heavily on student tuition dollars to fund public colleges and universities than any other state in the nation. No wonder so many Vermonters head out of state for college. In places like Utah and California, more than 90% of college students attend in-state institutions, but in Vermont, only half do. It's time for Vermont to make the first 2 years of college tuition free for all Vermonters. Doing so will ensure Vermonters can earn middle skill credentials valued in the local economy while also paving their way toward advanced degrees. And Linda has a lot of questions about this topic as well. She says, we're in a unique situation in Vermont because of years of neglect by the state in terms of funding for higher education. How do we get the state to support higher ed? How can we be better stewards of the meager resources we do get from the state in terms of such things as administrative versus instructional costs or unrestricted VSAC portability? How do we get the state to acknowledge and appreciate the value the state colleges bring to Vermont? And finally, how do we convince the 40% of Vermonters who graduate from high school but do not go on to college to stay in Vermont and attend one of the state colleges? All right, so let's talk about that. Jeb Spaulding, you said in February that the Vermont government needs to, quote, get the funding for public education back to where it was in the 1980s. Now, Vermont used to pay about 50% of the costs associated with the state college system. Now it pays about 15%. 10%. What does that mean for students?
It means that it's more expensive to go to college from Vermont. But again, I want to just first emphasize with people they should look further than the tuition levels, that there is federal aid, there's VSAC grants, there's increasingly all of the colleges within the system are trying to up their ability to provide institution from their college assistance for students to go. There's work study availability. There are a lot of ways to do it. You know, I would like to see us get back to where we were in the 1980s, but I think it would be unfortunate that we sort of say we can't make progress unless the legislature comes in and basically comes up with a whole lot of money. I think we need to look as a state as to how we're spending the money right now. One of the emails you mentioned talked about sending our taxpayer dollars to support students going to out-of-state colleges. That may have made sense in the 1980s. In fact, I think it might have. But now when you're talking about having the difficulty we are having supporting the public infrastructure we have, I think we need to look at how we're spending the existing funds as well as think about how we're going to get new money. We're going to continue to advocate for the legislature to come up with more money. I'd love to see us have 2 years of free post-secondary education. But I don't think, given the realities out there, that we can count on that. So we're not. We're looking for other ways that we can try to, help people afford to go to college. And I actually.
So you think you can lower tuition costs and improve the viability or sustain the viability of the colleges without a greater investment by the legislature?
Well, let me mention too. Yasmin mentioned the dual enrollment program, which there are over 1,000 students that got college credit in this year.
And these are high school students.
High school students, yes.
So they go to high school and get college credit.
Getting college credit. There were, in the hundreds, low hundreds of students that are now taking advantage of an early college program where they are actually combining their senior year of high school with a full first year of college. So that if you were getting an associate degree, as far as the tuition costs go, that would be half. So, we're looking for creative ways, given the realities ahead of us, to try to make the education we have as affordable as we can. Each one of the colleges is also, as I just mentioned a minute ago, building up their own ability to provide financial assistance. So, one thing I've noticed is that it took about 30 years for Vermont to go from roughly half of our revenues coming from the state appropriation, which I would like to see us get back to sometime, down to where we are. Many other states have had precipitous declines in state support since 2008 and 2009, much bigger than ours have. So, I think we're all in the same boat together. I mean, the challenge we face, and this gets into the challenges, I know we don't have a lot of time, we want to talk about, Vermont Technical College and others. The challenge that all of our colleges in Vermont and in the Northeast face is that the number of high school graduates is declining. So I'm not talking about percentages going on to college. I'm talking about raw numbers. The same thing that's affecting K-12 in terms of the population, student population, is going down. And when you're at a point where, you're roughly 85% of your revenues are coming from tuition, if your pool is getting smaller, that's a challenge. If the state appropriations are stagnant, that's a challenge. So what are we going to do about that? Some of the things that were mentioned there, if we can move the dial somewhat on the percentage of students that right now, it's still June, thousands of students that are graduating from high school this June will not be in post-secondary education this fall. That is a crying shame for those individuals, and it's not a good thing for our state economy. If we can actually just move that 5 or 10%, that will have a big impact on the bottom line of the state colleges. If we can provide the support that allows those students to not only get to our front door, but walk out the other side with a degree, that will help our bottom line. And, I'm also doing everything I can and hope to do more of not just talking about the challenges, but talking about the incredible educational opportunities that the state college system has for students. And it's both academic and experiential. I love talking about a junior from Johnson State College who was from a small town in Lamoille County, and she's currently in Russia, and she's earning 6 credits. And the interesting thing is it's not a Johnson State College program. It's actually a Lyndon State College program. And when you come to the Vermont State College system, you don't only get the resources of one college, you get the resources of a increasingly comprehensive and interconnected system. So, what we're doing is a challenge, and I think this plays into the Vermont tech issue. you know, because
Vermont Technical College has been operating with a pretty significant budget deficit. It was more than $7 million a deficit previously. It's now down to, I think, $4 million?
Well, the $7 million is cumulative. So it's been happening over a course of years, and they have a multi-year plan to restore themselves to into financial stability in the black.
That's right. It's $7 million they've borrowed from the state college system to pay back.
Yes, their deficit for the year that's ending in June 30 is roughly 2.2 of that 7+ million.
Got it.
So they're turning it around. I think the momentum is like strong down there. Last week we accepted a nearly $2 million gift of an incredibly beautiful dairy farm in Norwich, which we're going to use to transform our agricultural programs and build partnerships with other colleges and universities. The governor was down in Randolph Center yesterday talking about the $1 million appropriation that's intended to upgrade the lab facilities. And I'm not talking about building the new $25 million lab at Vermont Tech. I'm talking about improving our manufacturing and electrical engineering technology labs in Randolph and Williston. So, you know, I actually think, yeah, they've been going through challenges, the same kind of challenges other people have. The thing about Vermont Technical College is that it's predominantly Vermonters. Linden State College, on the other hand, they've got these, you know, nationally acclaimed niche programs where they have 25 graduates that are working at ESPN. And, you know, everybody knows if you listen to The Eye on the Sky, you know, that you have graduates that are really acclaimed meteorologists. 42% of the students at Linden are from out of state. Vermont Tech is primarily in-state, so we're dealing with that limited high school population.
But the financial constraints
and the financial,
that come from
and that
having
is one,
an all-in-state.
Yeah. And I don't want to – because I don't want to be an apologist for the state. When I looked at – you know, both New Hampshire and Vermont are the two lowest in the country in terms of the amount of state support for public higher education. And when you look at, say, the University of New Hampshire and University of Vermont, or like a Castleton kind of college compared to a Keene State or a four-year college, you know, we're roughly in the same boat. But when I looked at New Hampshire, the amount of state support they give to their two-year colleges, both their community college and their the equivalent of a Vermont Tech, that even in New Hampshire, it's roughly twice as much as it is in Vermont. So, you know, I mean, we really do need to have the policymakers recognize the situation we're in and say, look, do we want a community college and do we want a Vermont Technical College?
Well, for an administration that you were part of that says, you know, secondary education and post-secondary education is the key, to then not be pushing harder for funding the state college system. And now here you are, the chancellor of the state colleges. You've been in that administration. You know, the legislature couldn't find the money. The governor couldn't find the money. And now you would like the legislature to find the money.
Well, I would like them to find the money, but I've also said we are not going to wait around to see if they can find the money. We're going to take action ourselves.
Well, let me bring Yasmin back in here because we're short on time. And actually, Jeb Spaulding, you've done a great job of covering the waterfront of some of the issues we wanted to cover. Castleton State, Linden State, VTC. But Yasmin Ziesler, what do you think is going to work to get this system back in order, given that, you know, we may be able to see the legislature appropriate more money for the state college system, but probably not up to 50% in the short term? Mm-hmm. And we heard, you know, Chancellor Spaulding saying part of it is getting more students enrolled. But just to play devil's advocate, you can hear people thinking, hang on a minute, I can't afford this system as it is. And now you're saying if just more of us pay into it, then we'll all be solvent, you know, which isn't exactly what the chancellor said. But what do you think is going to work?
Right. So, you know, I think we have work to do ourselves. But I also think it's a matter of looking and thinking about new kinds of partnerships. So, you know, when it gets back to that question of a student deciding between do I keep going with college or do I go work? You know, a high school guidance counselor or teacher who knows that student, maybe that student isn't quite sure what they're doing with the major, but there's probably somebody in the community who might be able to help communicate to the student what the value is. And we need to think about working really in every community and supporting all of our students. And then the other side is for ourselves to make sure that we're being as clear as possible. And, you know, new software technology can help us sort of streamline how we communicate our degrees and majors to make sure that students are making progress and feel good about the progress they're making.
All right. I want to ask you, Chancellor Spaulding, one very quick question because we're short on time, but Castleton State College would like to become Castleton University. You supportive of that?
I think they could definitely pass the test to be a university. It's something they've been working on for many years. The Board of Trustees needs to figure out how that will fit in with the entire system. And I think those questions about should Castleton be approved to convert to university, and what do we want as an overall governing system for the state colleges, or a successor to the state colleges, need to go hand in hand.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for today, but I appreciate you both coming in and grappling with some of these issues of funding, matriculation, graduation. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Jane.
A pleasure.
We've been talking with Jeb Spalding, Chancellor of the Vermont State Colleges, and Yasmeen Zeisler, Chief Academic and Technology Officer of the State Colleges. Coming up, folk artist Warren Kimball. Three different galleries will be celebrating the 80-year-old Brandon Painter's work this summer. We'll hear from him next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The paintings of Brandon artist Warren Kimball are easily recognizable, even to people who may not know his name. His folk art portraits of plump cats, picturesque barns, and stately roosters have been put on everything from greeting cards to salad plates. Three separate Vermont galleries will be showcasing more than 50 years of Kimball's work this month. VPR's Nina Keck sat down with Kimball at his Brandon home to talk about his work and about turning 80.
Warren Kimball is surrounded by antiques in the rambling 1820s home he shares with his wife, Lorraine. Out back is a small two-story garage he uses as a studio.
This is my little gallery now. This is the new work over here.
The new work is a departure from the quaint farm animals and patriotic flags that have made Kimball famous. It's bolder and more abstract. In one, a glowing sun rises over blue-green waves, creating an image that almost pulses.
People say when they see this, they see the newer things. Who did that? I said, I did. Because it's a little heavier, you know. It's even that, even the Sunshine series. And some people don't want to see it. You know, they want to see the folk art. They want to see how I do that. And that's the main act, you know. Act one. This is scene two. Or something. I don't know. So come up and see my studio, my nest. Toby, come on.
Toby, Kimball's 9-year-old dog, follows him up to a small, beautifully lit space with large, sun-filled windows. An easel stands at one end with tin cans and mason jars filled to overflowing with paintbrushes.
So this is my latest studio, and you can see what I've been working on.
Kimball points to a large table covered with small wooden boxes and all sorts of oddities. Children's blocks, clothespins, lamp bases, and odd-shaped industrial parts. Bits of whimsy that Kimball transforms into boxed collages and three-dimensional art he calls assemblages.
It all comes together, the whole thing. It's the love of the old, the art of the old, going to museums and seeing the old paintings, the antique paintings. It's all in one.
Art is the sum total of one's experiences, says Kimball, and at 80, he's absorbed a lot.
The Jersey Shore, the boardwalk, the color. I love the circus. I was taken to the circus every April. That's art. I mean, it's color, it's action, it's everything going on. Just everything around you is a total of your experiences that you see. And so you may not use it tomorrow, you may not use it 10 years from now, but the experience always comes back to you and makes the creative process happen.
Was born in Belleville, New Jersey in 1935. Despite the Depression, he says his dad had a good job with an insurance company, and his mom was a homemaker. One of his earliest memories is singing along with a player piano in his parents' living room.
Parents were wonderful, full of love and life. We were exposed to the player piano, where we sang I Know Every Old Song There Is, and that's what we did. We sang at the player piano. You must have been a beautiful baby, because baby, look at you now. And tea for two. Oh, I could go on and on. And my brother started taking dance lessons in New York when he was 3, I think.
Warren's brother Bob was 11 years older and something of a dance prodigy.
Danced on Broadway with Ethel Merman in the chorus. And he, as I say, he was 11 years older. So I traipsed into New York every Saturday through the Holland Tunnel in a 1937 Chevy and went to watch him take his dance lesson. They left me alone. They were kind of frantic with him. I was just given art supplies and encouraged to do artwork. And that was a gift.
Kimball says early on, he blended his love of art with an uncanny knack for making a buck.
Making things at Christmas and selling them up and down the street. You know, I used to make these crazy little angels, and I would paint people's windows for Christmas. And I was entrepreneurial as a youth.
In high school, Kimball was class president, a cheerleader, and involved in all sorts of activities. But his home life changed dramatically when he was 16. His mother died of cancer, and Kimball says he was on his own a lot. It was an early lesson in self-reliance. After graduating from college, Kimball got married, was drafted into the Army for 2 years, and around 1960 went into advertising. About the same time, he began to dabble in the antiques business.
I started refinishing old trunks, and that got me into it. And then I started learning about antiques and buying and selling folk art and doing shows and so forth as a sideline.
In 1970, Kimball, his wife, and son Chris moved to Vermont. They bought a house in Brandon, and Kimball taught art and worked at Castleton State College. But the marriage wasn't working, and he and his first wife divorced in 1974. Kimball raised his son. 2 years later, Kimball met and married Lorraine, his current wife, who brought two children of her own to the family.
When I was teaching at Castleton, I was being a father, a husband, buying and selling antiques, painting like crazy, and just having to love the teaching.
Kimball left teaching reluctantly to focus on art and antiques full time. He admits the antiques business wasn't going so well, but he got a huge break artistically in 1990 when a Woodstock couple who were launching a publishing business saw his work at a local antique show.
And they said, well, could we make prints of your work? And I said, prints? I'm an artist, you know. Today, that's the opposite. But anyway, so I said, okay. And Lorraine said, well, maybe we can make some money on it.
John and Laurie Chester of Wild Apple Graphics chose six of his paintings, reproduced them, and headed for New York City.
So there we are in New York at Art Expo, the big, huge art show. And they're selling these reproductions like crazy. Two cows kissing that have the state of Vermont on their rumps. You know, I just did that for fun, you know, and that's where kind of my humor comes in. And it took off. It went bananas.
Kimball's quaint folk art was the perfect antidote to the slick, glitzy art of the 1980s.
It was at the right time, the right place. The mood of the nation was right.
Everything just clicked.
Then I get an agent who then gets things put on pillows and wallpaper and fabric. And all of a sudden, we're in business. Lorraine and I, but especially Lorraine, is learning business.
His wife, Lorraine, he says, became indispensable as a business partner.
Every artist, in order to be successful, if it hits like it did for me, the pure luck of it, has to have somebody take care of them, because you can't do both. Your head doesn't work that you can be creative and thinking about the agent and the agency and all that going on.
Lorraine took care of all that. Still does, he says. Kimball thinks his art resonates with both men and women because of its simplicity. He uses a special glaze to make his paintings look old, but there are no cars or carriages in his art, no costumes, nothing that can give you a sense of time. Kimball admits to feeling somewhat typecast as a folk artist, but with 6 million reproductions of his paintings circulating worldwide, he says that's okay.
My art, no, it may not be in New York. And I may not be, Jasper Johns or Norman Rockwell or somebody, but I have as many prints out as Norman had. I shouldn't call him Norman. Norman Rockwell. And I love his work. But my art is art for people and of the people. And so I'm in houses. I'm in bathrooms. I mean, please. You know, that's the fun of it. That's what makes it real.
The early 1990s were a heady time professionally for Warren Kimball, with his art popping up seemingly everywhere. But they were difficult years personally. Kimball's son Chris was diagnosed with AIDS, and he was in and out of hospitals for 2 years until his death in 1992.
He gave me a great gift because he was 29. We had such wonderful conversation that he gave me the gift of being able to go on. Now, some people may not understand that, but it's a gift.
Kimball says the outpouring of support he got from neighbors in Brandon at the time was also a gift. To give back, Kimball helped found the Brandon Artists Guild 15 years ago, an organization of 50 artists who sell their work in town. Over the years, he's also served on a number of collegiate and artistic boards. And while Kimball turned 80 this year, he has no intention of slowing down.
I don't like the word retirement because I don't think artists retire. But I don't think I'll ever retire. It just doesn't, it's not in my vocabulary.
I ask him, after so many years of making art, if he has a favorite painting.
You know what my favorite is? The next one. Because after it's painted, after it's done, it's done. And when you sell a painting, you never see it again. So the next one is the creative spirit coming out again. So it's my favorite is always the next one.
There will likely be plenty of next ones, since Kimball says he still paints nearly every day, usually while listening to Broadway show tunes on the radio.
Well, yeah, sometimes I sing along. Right? Nobody's there to hear me, right? And once in a while, I get up and tap dance, too, but not normally, but once in a while.
For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Brandon.
There are three separate exhibitions of Kimball's work this summer in Middlebury, Brandon, and Brattleboro. We have details at vpr.net. Last week, we talked with two doctors and a tick expert about Lyme disease, and that's one of the topics we have in today's listener comments. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me now to read from your messages to the show. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So two big areas of contention in Lyme disease are whether there is a condition that can be called chronic Lyme and whether ongoing symptoms of Lyme should be treated with long-term courses of antibiotics. DJ wrote in with a sympathetic note saying, the question is not whether or not people are suffering. They are undoubtedly suffering from something.
Mm. We received a specific question from Gary, who writes, the doctor who was pretty much against long-term antibiotics and follows the CDC line did concede there's such a thing as chronic Lyme disease. What he didn't get into is what is the treatment if someone has chronic Lyme disease because they were not treated initially. If someone develops serious neurological symptoms because they weren't treated initially, then what do you do? If not term long-term antibiotics, what then?
Okay, so we forwarded Gary's question to Dr. Jeffrey Parsonet, one of our guests, and he wrote us back this note. Yes, Lyme disease can cause chronic infection if it is not treated, as is the case with many infections. That is different than the expression chronic Lyme disease. Chronic Lyme is a phrase often used to describe the presence of persistent symptoms even after a patient has been treated appropriately. If someone has had Lyme in the past and was not treated, then he or she should be evaluated for possible late Lyme disease, as dictated by his or her symptoms. Late Lyme disease often involves the central nervous system, so a careful neurological workup should be done. And Dr. Parsonet says this often includes an MRI scan of the brain, a spinal tap, and looking for evidence of neurological disease. Patients with evidence of neurologic disease should be treated with ceftriaxone intravenously for 4 weeks. Studies have shown that treatment beyond 4 weeks does not provide additional benefit.
Okay, moving on now from ticks to two recent topics about families. In advance of Father's Day, we talked about the changing role of dads, and Michael wrote in after that discussion and says, I take great pride in getting up in the morning, putting my daughter's hair in a French braid, and taking my kids to school. Then I go to work as a carpenter and frame a house, then come home and finish my day by reading books to my children. I can't imagine my father having the same daily interaction with me as I do with my kids. It's a whole different ballgame.
And after yesterday's discussion of kids who do genealogy research, Annie posted this comment. I tuned in this evening just in time to hear the young lady who called in talking about the tools she used in researching her genealogical project. I'm impressed. Holy cow. When I think of all the time I wasted learning to do things the hard way, sometimes I just want to be a kid again.
And Annie adds, history has meaning when you can place someone you are connected to in context. I was happy to hear your guest talk about adoptees doing research on their adopted families. Genetics are only part of who we are. We are cultural beings, and a lot of who we are is passed down and shaped by the people we grow up with. Thanks for a great show.
Well, whether you agree we're great or we occasionally miss the mark, we do want to know what you're thinking, so get in touch with us anytime through social media or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, raising capital for small business. Small businesses are the backbone of the economy, but how does someone get the necessary money to purchase an existing company or to expand her own business? We'll discuss where funds are available for potential small business owners. Send your questions or your experiences to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.